impact on the climate? And the answer is yes, but not conclusive. And there are various hypotheses. If you step back and think about it, the primary driver for all of this, of course, is the arriving solar radiation. So that if that varies, and it does, then that will drive temperature variability. And there are a number of ways in which the sun emissions can vary. One of the common ones is the sunspot cycle, and there is a specific cyclic variation there called the Maunder cycle, and that affects arriving solar radiation. The solar wind also certainly has an effect on arriving cosmic rays, and one of the discussions that went on, relatively inconclusively, is that if you blow the cosmic rays away with a stronger solar wind, then there are fewer nucleating particles arriving in the upper atmosphere to cause condensation and clouds. And people went off and looked at the various paintings done in different climatic periods to see if they could see any detectable variation in clouds. And there was some argument that said, well, when it's cold, you can see there are more clouds in the old master's paintings. But it's all terribly tenuous and very, very hand-waving. But the bottom line is, certainly solar emission, solar radiation, is profoundly important. We have a reasonable but incomplete understanding of the dynamics of the sun and the way it works. It's a rather complicated object, and there is evidence of a sort. It's about the same as the evidence for economic cycles. So you can see it if you look closely, and if you look at it from a slightly different angle, you don't see it. So the answer is perhaps, I'm afraid.
Any other comments or questions? Let's go to that slide first, and then to the two people back here.
Yes, hello. I think that was a very interesting thing to do. It's something that I've been interested to see, and I'd like to know if you've maybe written that up about the model, that someone could read it online or something.
Oh, which model?
The you made a sort of first order model looking at the black body radiation.
Oh, yes. Well, yes, a colleague of mine has done that. That's Professor Bjorn Magnusson at the Norwegian Technical Institute.
Well, I maybe got that up, but I did look at a book in where they looked at atmospheric modelling, and my recollection is that without the greenhouse gas, the temperature of the planet would be something like minus 20.
Oh, yes, so yes, the bare planet, yes.
An enormous difference already. So I think even if you've got to the, even if 80% of the effect, we're only going to see another 8%. It just seemed off the top of my head, without seeing the math behind it, it seemed that one might have expected more than half a degree rise in temperature, and that you'd probably be aware that the climate model is here at Cambridge, like Professor Mars Allen, for instance. They would estimate that for every half a trillion tonnes put into the atmosphere, you get another 1 degree.
Ah, but that's because they're using the water vapor enhancement. That's not from bare carbon dioxide.
No,
that's absolutely critical.
Exactly. So there's quite a difference.
Oh, there is. Yes.
Two ways of modeling.
No, absolutely. And so in the scientific way of dealing with that, you say, let me go and take a look at the data, and the data shows half a degree. So far, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. But, again, if we go back to the slide, must be able to get the slide up again.
So the other argument is that there's a terrific lag effect before you see the effects of the...
Well, but you then have to say, where's the lag coming from? Occam's razor and all that says...
Well, you haven't got to equilibrium.
Sorry?
You haven't got to equilibrium, whereas in your model you're saying we're at equilibrium.
No, the gaseous component goes very quickly to equilibrium. So if you're going to plead in aid the idea of a lag, you have to explain why, when you have the half degree available at the surface of the ocean, that for some reason the water vapour is not coming off. You know, there aren't effects in the system that would plausibly account for a lag. But let me just bear with me a second.
Maybe the high specific high heat capacity in the ocean.
No, it's a surface temperature effect. I used to do this sort of thing for a living, and the rate of vaporization from a free surface where you have a temperature gradient is very prompt. There isn't a big lag. If you were thinking about pulling stuff out of the deep oceans, so you're thinking about a temperature reservoir where you're going to have to impact the deep oceans, then you can find lags, because the thermal capacity of the ocean is very high. But at the surface, where the vaporization is going to occur, it is quite prompt. It's the boiling kettle thing. There is not a one-hour lag between putting the heating element on in your kettle and the water boiling. It's prompt. Well, it depends on the kettle, of course, yes. But, this is, in geological time, this is a short period. But if you look back over the record, you don't see it. So you can certainly plausibly say that it's true. But if there's a lag, why are we rushing, destroying our economy now by imposing penalties? It's just not rational. See, this is a long time. That's a millennium. And the temperature's varying in the absence of carbon dioxide. I mean, the perfectly respectable truth is that the climate modellers do not have good enough models to understand the atmosphere in the way in which they claim. One of the primary determinants of weather is the jet stream. And the jet streams in the upper atmosphere, it determines where meteorological events occur in the oceans and over land. And if it wobbles a little bit, it has major impacts on the weather. Mm. Now, the weather, there's this temptation amongst people to say, well, the weather's nothing to do with climate. But it is. Because if the weather changes and you change the cloud cover, it has a major impact on the climate models. And the climate models cannot deal with multiphase flow events at the moment. So it's wrapped up in a matter of belief in the multiplier. And that's what isn't sufficiently exposed to public debate at the moment. It's actually just a computational fluid dynamics model with a fudge factor in. And the fudge factors in engineering are very good for interpolating between known bounds. They are truly awful for extrapolating. It's rather like having a financial model of the exchange rate.
I'm aware your hands are. I do want to make sure everybody's kind of trying to get something in. We've got somebody over there, then two at the back. Try and hold the thought if you wouldn't mind and come back to it later. Can we move on to the other side?
Three short questions, but they're difficult ones to answer. The first is, you want facts, and there are some real facts, like the quite convincing beginnings of the loss of the albedo effect from the ice caps, and the possibility of the vicious circle already beginning of the release of methane from the tundra. That's the first question. The second is, you seem to love the ocean to be a heat sink, but a CO2 sink as well. But what about the observable destruction of coral reefs and the impact on fish, which is going to be disastrous if we're not careful? And then thirdly, there's the issue of population, because we know, it's a fact, that that all of tomorrow's parents are alive today, and as a consequence, that bulge of young people, especially in Africa and Asia, when we absolutely know, short of catastrophe, we're going to have another 3,000 million people in the world.
Oh, absolutely.
Before stabilisation. So those three factors require the precautionary principle. You talk about time lag, but the precautionary principle says by the time things get bad, it might be too late to do enough about it.
Well, the precautionary principle, poorly applied, can also make things bad before they need to be. and that's what's going on at the moment. All of this data has built in the fact that tomorrow's parents are alive. There is likely to be a very substantial increase in population. What the early slide that I showed you shows that that will not be throttled by a lack of energy. There is plenty of solar energy to sustain a population at the foreseeable level at the American standard of living.
But there will be a lot of greenhouse gases released, won't there, as they get out of poverty?
Indeed. But the point that I make is that it doesn't matter if you release a lot more greenhouse gases from the thermal point of view. Now, there may be other effects to do with ocean acidification, but those need to be discussed. And you have to then show that those effects are worth taking the economic damage that a dash to get rid of CO2 will require, given that in the normal course of events, there will be a migration away from fossil fuels to solar electric. I wouldn't go further than say at some point in this century. The present data suggests it'll happen about mid-century. Now, if it's happening about mid-century, we've got most of it on here. And if then the temperature is not going to rise, we don't have to worry about the warming effect. There may be other effects. I cannot comment on those, but it's an argument to make.
What about vicious cycles, though?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I didn't deal with that one. No, quite right. You were quite right. If you look at the data, there is something odd going on in the Arctic, because the Arctic is warming disproportionately. Yeah. But the impact of albedo will be modest, because necessarily the pole is at a glancing angle to the incoming solar radiation, so the impact of albedo will be slight. If the tundra begins to emit methane, that's more of a risk.
It's 20 times more powerful, isn't it, than CO2 as a greenhouse?
Yes, it's a very substantial greenhouse gas. But again, if you remember the concentrations that I showed you, it's also a terribly tiny trace gas in the atmosphere. So you can look at multiplying factors, but you need concentration times multiplier. And the concentration is terribly small. Here's the methane, 0.066%.
So far.
So far, yes. But then you would need to make the argument, you can say catastrophic's a handy word. You need to produce data and sensible models rather than just raise worries. I mean, you can raise worries about people dying in the UK if the power generating system goes down because of a lack of electricity supplies in hospitals. You can raise worries all over the place. You need to quantify the risk in order to make rational policies rather than essentially frighten people.
But just before we move on, you're going to give me your slides, aren't you?
You can just copy the recording.
Because I know a lot of people were thinking that they didn't see your slides.
No, indeed.
Can we go to the back there and then right in the far corner?
Hi, so I was wondering, what are your ideas about why climate scientists disagree with you? Are they being dishonest, or are they incompetent, or something else?
Well, I think that's really a most interesting question. If I can address it from a slightly oblique angle, one of the things that worries me profoundly is that if my position is correct and it emerges that the global warming issue has indeed been a scare, it will have a hugely damaging effect on public trust in science. And that is particularly profound because bodies like the Royal Academy of Engineering, of which I'm a member, the Royal Society, of which I'm not, the Institute of Physics, of which I am, have all endorsed this view that global warming is a real and serious threat. Now, I can tell you, in the two bodies of which I am a member, that the competence of the groups who endorse the view to make a judgment is very slight. They are not specialists in the area, and they have not only not specialists in the science, but they have made a political judgment. Because the issue as to whether global warming is a material threat is actually an economic issue. It's not a scientific one. It's about the impact on human well-being. And I've raised that in the Institute of Physics, but there is a mindset that says, no, this is all well-established science. And if you look at it, it's not. And what's going on is rather like the eugenics furore that occurred in the 20s. where lots of politicians and quite a number of perfectly respectable scientists formed a view that eugenics was a good idea, and it led to all sorts of adverse consequences in America. There's an excellent book called But Is It True?, which is written by a statistician. If you want the reference, I can give it. I've got it on the shelf at home, but I can't remember the name of the author. And it's a compendium of articles looking at various fearful scares. I mean, the eugenics one was about genetic pollution of the human race by people who aren't well and so on. And what happens is that people do not actively conspire. They form a sort of social group and do things that they wouldn't do as individuals. But the climate scientists might be an exception to that, because what first alerted me, or what first caused me to take a close interest in the area, was the incident in, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s, where some climate scientists admitted that they jimmied the data because they thought the problem was so profound. The other feature that occurs in science, regrettably, which is a social activity of human beings, is people like to get their grants renewed. And a good way of getting your grant renewed is to say, gosh, this is a terribly important problem. I used to do it myself. You know, the nuclear industry was built around. This is a terribly important problem. If we don't do it, the Russians will. So you need to fund us. So there are non-scientific arguments that go into the grant formulation process. So I think it's a mixture between deliberate mendaciousness, because I think there is some evidence for that happening, and also the herd mentality. And it's a well-known phenomenon. But have a look at the book. But Is It Really True? Is the title. It's rather thick, but it's a well worthwhile read.
They're in the far corner then.
A couple of points. The first one is that let's assume for the moment. I'm happy to assume for the moment that you are right in everything you say. But what that means is that we are going around like a drunk in a bar, scrabbling to wring the dregs out of the last marginal oil reserves that we possibly can, which are arguably creating some really significant environmental effects.
Nope.
Terms of things like the tar sands in Canada and so on. And so, and we're drilling in more and further and further into deep water and so on. And so maybe there's an argument which isn't to do with global warming, but which is about saying, actually, we need to wean ourselves off oil because the oil's just getting crazier and crazier every time.
Let me deal with that straight away. If that was true, if it was getting unconscionably hard to find extra reserves, you would see this curve turning down because it would be getting too expensive. And what happens with the oil companies is they go and look for oil to try to hold the horizon at a order 40 or 50 years. And it's an entirely tractable process. Yes, we are drilling in deeper waters, but shale is on land. The Canadian stuff is certainly quite environmentally damaging, but there's plenty of space around. But the key response to your question is that in the natural course of events, we will come off oil. And we'll come off oil because solar power will become cheaper. It's the same reason we reduced wood burn. The reason we're not burning lots of wood now is it's very inconvenient, and it's smelly, and it's dangerous. And it's also quite expensive to gather now. So there'll be a natural economic migration. So I'm not trying to defend the idea that we should stay on oil and not make efforts to move away from it. What I am saying is there is no need for a panic-like rush. We should be funding solar electric, but more importantly, we should be looking for low-cost, high-efficiency electrolysis or some other storage device. Better batteries.
Great, good. Okay, so then the second point is, I'm going to try and encapsulate something that I think you said. So I think what you said is that the climate models which are currently out there are based upon a somewhat fudgy relationship between the CO2 level and the water.
Correct.
Level. And we don't know what that relationship is.
That's true too.
Yeah.
Well, we need to be a little more careful than that. In terms of physics, we know what the relationship is. It's just too difficult to calculate.
Exactly. So we can't say on the global level how those two things will interact.
That's correct.
Yeah. And so in that situation, what we come into, which I think our friend over the other side was talking about, and you've mentioned, is we come into a battle of two opposing precautionary principles.
Mm.
On the one hand, we're saying we must do something because the consequences in the long term to the global climate system will be too great. On the other hand, we're saying we can't come off oil because the consequences to the short-term economic system would be too great.
Mm-hmm.
And in that situation, there's no way of finding facts out of that situation because they're basically two unknowables, and it comes down purely to a question of what sort of future. What sort of values do we apply? What kind of priorities do we
true.
Have for the sort of life that we want to lead?
That is not true. The scientific approach to dealing with that circumstance, which is quite common, it was the discussion that Galileo had with the Catholic Church. And the way you deal with it is with data.
Galileo's Church did not have short-term and long-term impacts on the economic system.
No, they had huge short-term impacts. If Galileo was right, the Church was wrong, and the Church was a major mover in the economy at that time. That's why they took it so seriously. It's a very, very good parallel, and Galileo had data, and so do we. We have lots of data. And that's the scientific method, and that's why it's so useful. It's not about argument, and it's not about who shouts the loudest. I will be, if I was presented with a data set tomorrow which showed me that the climate modellers were right, I would instantly reverse my position. It's got to be about the data. And what's wrong at the moment is it's turned into a philosophical debate of the type you were heading for. And that philosophical debate is likely to produce, in my estimation, I'm no expert in the area, quite serious adverse consequences. So policies, government policies, should be so far as possible evidence-driven. And we have lots of evidence when it isn't jiggered about.
Can we have an next gentleman, which I'll do, and then maybe to
is there any... anything within the ice songs that they've taken great depths to indicate Earth history that impacts upon your documents?
That's where this comes from. Measurements of atmospheric CO2 and measurements
right.
of global temperature. That's ice core.
Right. Okay.
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 We should
I know.
And then we'll come back to Bob.
Oh, yes, I was forewarned of this question, and it fits with the response that I just gave.
Yes. One of my colleagues, or a friend of mine, has recently written a book on alternative energy sources, and one of the things he's suggesting is indeed solar energy use, and he, like you, believes that it will become a major driver in the next decade or two. But what he's suggesting is that perhaps it should be done on a world scale with an international power grid, so that although there'll be electricity being generated here and there at different times of the day, there'll be some times at night where we can't use it. Therefore, if we have an international grid, we can generate it in one place and use it where it's needed at any time.
A very interesting idea, and it will work the minute we have a room temperature superconductor, because the transmission losses on an international scale would be so large that it would really be quite impractical. But if you like, at the mathematical level, it's an appealing idea. And as I said to you when we talked about this offline a little bit, A perhaps slightly better method would be to produce a micron-thin aluminium foil somewhere between the Earth and Moon orbit that turns day, night into day on the night side and reduce the need. But that would have an impact on people's lives. But the technological challenge of the conductivity of the grid and managing the grid is really quite substantial.
Over here, and then we'll come back to the chap in the corner.
Oh, just forgive me. But it also doesn't work for transport. For transport energy or transport power, you really do need a portable storage system. And slightly mischievously, you could suggest that nature gave us one. It's called the carbon molecule. And what you do is hang hydrogens on a carbon molecule, you've got a very compact liquid fuel which will move you around, and providing all you're doing is taking carbon from the atmosphere and hanging the hydrogen on that, it is, it's neutral. And when I was at the Defence Academy, I did once say to the Admiral who happened to be in charge that one of the good arguments for keeping a navy is in the latter part of the century, it just might be that we'll have huge solar farms floating out in the equatorial oceans with solar cells generating electricity with CO2 absorbers making liquid and gaseous fuels which are shipped home. But you would need to defend them. Aircraft carriers without planes won't work. But he went away to think about that.
I would endorse that because, as you well know, my specialty was motor vehicles and transport. And the truth is, the hydrocarbon fuels that we currently use and can synthesise by using electrolysis and so on, or indeed but from coal, which has been done both in history and relatively recently in South Africa, those fuels are the most energy dense.
Oh, yeah.
And they are, you know, the notion of using, for instance, alcohols rather than the regular fossil fuels is really a poor alternative. Vehicles that need dense energy sources.
Yeah.
Okay, over here then.
I mean, you said you alluded.
Be closer, please, boss.
Sorry, you alluded to the fact that we will be significantly running out of fossil fuels in 50 years' time.
No, that's not what I said.
That has also been mentioned by the oil companies.
Yeah, but that's not what they're saying. We need to understand what the data shows. This is the oil. Here is the ratio of oil reserves to consumption. So you take the reserve, divide it by consumption, it tells you how much oil you know that you have. So we have 50 years' worth. Next year, we will still have 50 years' worth. And the year after that, and the year after that. What the oil companies are telling us is that they're able to replenish the oil reserve by discovery without any particular difficulty. So in certainty, we have 50 years. In probability, we probably have 100 or two. We'll get a signal when the oil begins to run out, because each year, the known reserve will drop by a year. And there is no sign of that at all.
But when... I mean, in my own lifetime, there have been several fuel panics. There have been several oil crises.
Yeah.
And so I assume that we will have stepwise oil crises increases in oil prices.
No, I have a slide. I wonder if I can get it up. But I have a slide which deals with exactly this point. And there are huge spikes in the oil price. But they're not generated by intrinsic supply, they're generated by political events. So when you have a source of supply that's suddenly turned off, like the Middle East in the Yom Kippur War, there's a huge spike in the oil price.
But the oil price never comes down.
Oh, yes, it does. Oh, yes, it does. Let me see if I can...
In my memory, I've never known oil this expensive.
It's much cheaper as does.
The oil price...
£1.35, I've never known it that high.
There are two effects in play. One is inflation, and one is the cost of oil. And if you do an inflation-corrected plot, we have only very recently, in the last year or two, exceeded the real price of oil as it was back in 1950. And so if you plot the real price of oil over time, it does this.
But it's not a resource that is infinite. It will come to an end at some point.
Yes.
And 50 years before it comes to an end, there will be an almighty oil crisis in the world.
No.
No?
No.
Another question is, what
well,
do you...
No, well, let me just deal with your question, because I can see disbelief on your face. We see 50 years now. Now, we don't know now whether it's going to drop or not. In fact, it dropped then. There wasn't a crisis. It dropped for several years here. There wasn't a crisis. So long as there is a supply of available oil to meet economic need, the price cannot go up too much. Because if it does, someone else will enter the market. It's capitalism.
Okay.
So there's a moderator.
Okay, but that graph can't go on to infinity.
No,
because there's a finite
amount of oil.
The point that I try to make...
is if you take today's date, which is 2013, and add 50 years to it, that's 2063.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm suggesting to you is that well before 2063, the price of solar electric will have fallen so
but
much.
You can't run cars on solar electric.
With a proper battery system, you can.
And another just one
but,
more question.
But hence the discussion we just
you,
had.
You talked about nuclear energy. What do you see? What do you see as the in this country is going to reach a crisis in terms of nuclear energy? They're not going ahead and building new nuclear power stations, and they're not doing it right now. And they need to do it right now.
Yeah.
What do you think should be the future in this country for nuclear power?
Yes, if you're asking me if I was the energy minister,
yeah,
what would I do? If I was the energy minister, well, I wouldn't start from here. I must make that point, because one of the things that the technological incompetence of successive governments has managed to ensure is that we do not have a technological competence in nuclear power in this country.
Yes.
We used to,
yes,
but we don't. We really don't have nuclear engineers
anymore.
And so if we are to build nuclear power stations, we will have to buy them from abroad. And there are a number of people who are able to buy them. Now, what I would do is I would underwrite the risk of nuclear accident for the nuclear power suppliers. And I would offset my risk, my financial risk in that area, by imposing very severe safety and management issues on the nuclear operators. So I would take the risk as the government, because I actually think it is very difficult for companies to absorb a risk of the magnitude that can happen in the unlikely event of a major nuclear incident like Chernobyl. So I would absorb the financial risk in government, but I would tightly regulate the nuclear providers, and I would try to get two or three of them bidding to build nuclear stations to supply electricity at a relatively low price. The price that they're asking at the moment is really very high. And it's high because the government is saying, no public subsidy, you must absorb all the risks. And that's a rather stupid position of the government. And they haven't really thought it through. It's quite right that the public should not carry a risk so that commercial ventures can make profit. But you can manage that in the way I described, by taking the underwriting risk and then moderating that by applying construction and operating rules. So I think we need about a 25%, no, need is the wrong word, I think it would be sensible for us to have a 25% component of our electricity generating capacity as nuclear.
I agree, but the government aren't doing that.
No.
We are wasting precious time.
Yeah, indeed.
Although I admire the political point, can we steer back a little bit to the science? We've got one point over there, and then maybe we'll one after that with the last one, so we can wrap up, let people get to their buses.
Hi again. So I just wanted to come back to that one of the first slides you made in your partial presentation, where you were saying about the, we don't have to be worried about the rising CO2, because you made a point where you said that no matter how much CO2 we add to the atmosphere, the total temperature increase couldn't exceed 0.5 degrees.
It's of that order.
But then a problem with that a data point problem with that is the planet Venus, which, as most of us will know, is hotter than Mercury despite being further from the Sun, primarily because it has 100 atmospheres worth of CO2 in its atmosphere, 100 Earth atmospheres worth of CO2.
Yes.
And, I mean, what Venus illustrates is that... What Venus illustrates is that the greenhouse effect of CO2 does not saturate at any level. And I'd like to suggest that the model you presented is not correct, because the way... thinking of CO2 as something that blocks heat radiation coming out of the Earth is not really the right way to think about it, because a better way is to consider it from, say, the point of view of an astronaut outside the Earth. You can see the heat radiation coming up. And what the greenhouse gases look like when you're looking at heat radiation is like a fog, which prevents you from seeing the surface of the Earth instead of seeing a layer several kilometres up. And then what increasing the greenhouse gases does is it thickens that fog and means that you then have to look at an atmospheric layer that's slightly higher.
No, it
a
doesn't.
Higher atmospheric layer is cooler and emits less radiation.
You're wrong.
And therefore, the entire lower atmosphere has to heat up in order to come back in equilibrium.
When you do a calculation like that, you get
a direct input of CO2, which is...
That would be true. No, that would be true if CO2 absorbed across the full band. But it doesn't.
Well, it is true, because what happens is as the radiation comes up and interacts with the atmosphere, interacts with like higher layers in the atmosphere,
the energy distributes
itself out, you know, amongst all the various modes, and so it gets re-radiated in particular wavelengths again. And so the radiation just keeps continuing.
That's just not true. The physics of the matter is that the molecules absorb and emit in bands, and outside the bands they have very little effect. So it's not like a fog. A fog is a dispersive mechanism. This is radiation absorption and re-emission in frequency bands.
Why would planet Venus disagree?
Well, the planet Venus has a very much denser atmosphere and it's much closer to the Sun.
Yeah, and not than Mercury.
Yeah, and Mercury has no atmosphere, so it doesn't have a greenhouse effect.
Well, yes, and
so
Venus,
you would expect Venus to be warmer.
Tens of degrees hotter than Mercury.
You would expect Venus to be all the... I mean, it's a very simple calculation, the one I present. And so it can be rerun for Venus. We'll see what the answer is. But the scientific argument that you present is just wrong.
Okay, we'll come over here. We'll make this the last open public question. You're very welcome to come and chat with
us. I'm glad you came to this diagram, because it seems to bear a ray of hope for me, in that if the same black body radiation curve is... the one that you show, there's only a tiny gap in that third band, which is the amount of radiation that might possibly be absorbed however much carbon dioxide you put in. Is that the right sort of approach? I mean, yeah. If the carbon dioxide concentration went right up...
This is the radiation being radiated outward.
Yes.
Okay, so what this is saying is that in this band where the outward radiation is small... there's actually quite a small effect.
Yes, but the residual, the bit that hasn't been absorbed...
Oh, no,
the
graph doesn't... that the intersection is not the amount which hasn't been absorbed. These are just radiation bands.
Right.
Those are the bands, and in order to determine how much has been absorbed of the incoming radiation, you need to know the density. Venus has a high one. And you need to know the absorptivity. And so you would have to do a calculation for each of these bands, because this is just an indicative diagram. It is certainly not the case, except by accident, that the breadth of that spike has anything to do with the actual breadth of the absorption band. But you can look that up in books, you know, it's hard data.
I'm going to slightly abuse my position and just ask you one thing. If you go back to your picture of... with the hump in medieval Europe, you know what I mean? That one. I did notice that's climatic changes in Europe, that's the temperature in Europe, it's not the average temperature of the Earth.
Oh, what no, absolutely.
What does it look like if you do the average temperature of the Earth for that period?
My understanding is it looks pretty much the same.
Okay. We feel, I think, probably members of the public feel very dependent on the data we're given for this whole question. You know, we've actually, over the years, had a lot of climate talks at this cafe. and it's interesting to kind of compare. We'd be very much appreciated if
you could have the slides. You could actually download them on the web too.
Lovely.
There's a version of this lecture available on the Defence Academy website. It's the one that I gave back in 2006. I think it was there or thereabouts, maybe 2007. And you can download what's called an SWF, and that will pull down the PowerPoint slides and my commentary, which synchronises with the slides and the question and answer session. And I'm happy to tell you that I was predicting, I think, cold winters there. I certainly did predict that for the worshipful country of Glazes in 2010.
I'm going to wrap it up there. I know we've got people who need to go to buses and things. I think Will's nicked down to open the door for them. Would you? Because somebody's just gone down.
Done.
Okay, fine. Lovely. So the door is open. Excellent. A few announcements before we close up. As usual, my thanks to my helpers. Can be fantastic in the middle there. Little round of applause at the end of the year. And also to the Oxford Biosciences Network, which has continued to support us. And a very, very big thank you to Dom, who definitely is down on the door since everybody else is, and to everybody who's hosted us here at Science Oxford Live. As you know, this venue is closing. That means the live in one venue operations of Science Oxford will cease. But their activities throughout the county, particularly outreach in schools, holding events in other venues, all that will carry on. The Trust is still very active. It's just that it won't have a home that you can visit and go and see a discovery zone and pick up leaflets and things like that. They will be using the offices in the building they have bought next to the mound, which is the old council offices. They'll be in there as their headquarters. It's already been used. And the problem will be that they won't have a place they can hold to accept this. So like us, they'll be spread over all over the place. However, we have now made a decision to forestall the likely queries. We have to take into account the fact we do really need to be very close to the centre of Oxford if we can. I know there are people who haven't come to this in the last 2 years because it's too far away from the bus drop-off points from their side of the city. We need to be central. We must be able to do it on the same day of the month, otherwise the irregularity just disappears. We need really for it to be almost zero cost or very low cost of leaving. That's almost impossible in Oxford, where a lot of places are trying to charge. We need to be able to have food and drink, otherwise you don't have a nice evening. And we need to want to try and be able to do it into the future. And I also ruled out colleges and departments where they might have somewhere accessible, but very much at the back, so we'd have to guide you through from the entrances. So having ruled all of those out, we are going to move to the University Museum Visitor Centre. As I said on the email today, if you were to stand looking at the University Museum, known as the Dinosaur Museum by my nephew and many others, well, you're back to the road, sat to Parks Road, looking straight at the front, the visitor is directly to the right-hand side of the main museum, and it fits in between the main museum and the entrance to Pitt Rivers. It will be open more or less kind of straight away in the autumn. We're going to go in there on the second Tuesday of September. The whole programme I will put out by email, so if you haven't signed up to our mailing list, please do so. There's on our flyers is how to do it. If you need to unsubscribe, then that's automatic as well. You don't need to contact me particularly about it. It's all on the standard mailing list for the Oxford type. And we will be in there for the whole of next year. I am still perfectly happy to move if we find somewhere better. The one thing that's different is that although it's roughly the size of this room, there are actual walls and things in the way between the three thirds. So it is not as ideal, and we may be a little bit more crammed into where we're sitting so the speaker can talk to everybody at the same time. But every other aspect is perfect. There will be disabled access, we can get the key at night without bothering anybody, and we can do what we like in terms of food, drink, projection, audio facilities, etc. So that's the plan to move. We take a break in August as usual. We'll see you back in September on the second Tuesday of September, and after that on the second Tuesday of each month. As I said, I'll put out the programme. I'll also get the website completely fixed. Apologies for the issues. And I'll also email around when I've got all the audio files up from this year. There are still about 3 months' worth I need to put up. I'll be putting up Philip's slides as well. A little bit of a thank you, please, to Dom, who's been great at hosting us. And a big thank you to everybody who comes and to our speaker tonight, Philip Hutchinson. Carry on chatting to him. We have to keep him entertained while we clear up. Thanks very much, guys. Have a good summer.
May I just make sure that I have her name? So I wanted to look it up. Is that your maybe I could. I don't know if it's a reference or something. But I'm looking at that. I assume if I sort of Google you, then I'll get that.
Is this a website?
He's an emeritus now at the at NTH in Trondheim.
Trondheim.
All right. And he sent me a private communication of his calculations, but he's presented them publicly in Norway, so they're a matter of record.
Okay.
Yeah. Mind making a note of what the website was? Was Defence Academy? Or enough to.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. If you write your email down, what I will do is I will send you an email with a web link, so you can go straight away and download them.
Other people might like that, such as me. I don't know if you could tag it onto your slide.
Absolutely, I'll do that. Yes,
tag it onto your slide.
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah, I'm very happy.
I was very happy to do that.
You'll stick it on the slide, so we can find your email.
I will give it to Rachel, so she can
solve
the problem.
Has mine.
I think he's trying to. In fact, Rachel already has it.
Do it to Rachel.
Because what I was originally.
I'd like him to have my email address.
Okay. I said, why don't you have a look at this and send her it?
All right.
But I will send her it again, and I will ask that she adds it to the slide. If she can't, I can probably send her another PowerPoint slide by mail. Yeah, I'll solve the problem with her.
Right. Thank you very much.
So and you mentioned a book. Did you say, is it true?
Yes. Is it really true? I'll add that to the email. Yes. It's a really outstanding. The advantage for me of giving lectures like this.
No, don't worry. I'll tell my wife.
The advantage for me of giving lectures like this is every so often somebody will come and drop a nugget for me. And when I gave the lecture at Crenfield, this chap turned up afterwards and he said, you should read the book, Is It True? It's about all sorts. The same point came up about the sociology of scares.
Yes.
But I went out and bought it. And here it is. It's a statistician's analysis.
Right.
Outstanding. Yeah. And you can get it. And I think I bought mine from Amazon.
That's
it's about 10 or 15 quid.
So I could leave those two email addresses from the Defence Academy.
Yep. Yep.
Yes. Christopher Booker wrote a book called Scared to Death, which is all about.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, it's the same sort of issue.
Worked its way out.
Sorry.
And then that will deal with it.
I hope so. Yes.
Oh yeah.
No. Methane is highly combustible, so it will be transformed into carbon dioxide and water. But carbon dioxide is really a very inert and very, very stable molecule.
It just stays there forever.
It just stays there forever, gets recycled, just gets transformed into things like carbonate. You're taking digestion pills, plus CO2 in there. So you can trap it in solids. And so the point that was made over here about coral reefs is slightly moot, because you get an enhanced formation of corals that have lots of CO2 about. But also, if you acidify the oceans, you get some erosion, so it's a dynamic process, and you really need to have to work it out rather carefully.
Well, thank you very much.
Not at all.
That one about using Venus as a model for the Earth's future was debunked long ago.
Yes.
When the New Scientist is not elsewhere.
No,
absolutely.
Reading
that.
Yes.
Was that you can't say, so Venus has gone like this. So
yes, was that so small in the Middle Ages?
Everyone had a phone.
Yeah.
It's so damaging the economy to for it all to be based on oil. Isn't it? Enhancing the economy to get into solar power and the areas
it's more efficient.
Yes.
Than big power.
The question is, at what rate can you do it?
Each your house.
See, if we look at the.
Towards
use of proper interest.
And so the answer is yes, and that I believe is exactly what will happen.
For which, sorry?
And you can't trade the one for the other. I can't find the slide that I'm looking for. But the slide that I want is the one where we look to the future. And you know, it's a democracy. You have to persuade people to do these things. You can't simply direct them to do that.
It's going to be very hard to get to 30% where we're going to go from 20%.
We used to be.
This is the magnitude of the problem. This is the substitution You have to have a population crisis.
But you've got to train a nuclear engineer.
Because the economy, a Victorian economy, will not sustain the population that we have. So what we would the rational and humane thing to do is to migrate from oil to a sustainable resource, which is solar, in a time scale where we can do it without wrecking our ability to deliver it. See, if, let's suppose tomorrow we say we're going to reduce our carbon emissions by 50% by fear, by law. You're just going to do it, you can't
have sure that's right, because it stops.
What would happen is that the technological capacity in the economy would fall to such an extent that it is most unlikely that solar power would come on stream cheap in the century. It might not happen for 300 years. Meantime, people are dying, and I don't mean dying. They're dying because they can't afford it. But again, in the longer term, what you have to recognise is that what physics tells us is if you have enough energy, available energy, as we talk about, or free energy as a thermodynamic or the economic sense, you can manufacture anything you like. And what will catch you in the end is not CO2, but entropy. That's definitely where you get low-grade system. But again, if you look at it from a human race point of view, if we don't get off this planet in the next million years or two, we'll die with the sun. You know, so it's like riding a bicycle. You have to keep riding the bicycle.
We're not riding it all that well at the minute, but we're staying upright.
We
should advise the government.
I try to, but they don't take any notice.
Dan Walsh should, especially the Minister of Energy.
Yes, indeed.
You're a pal of Nigel Lawson, I suppose.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
And he said, you didn't mention it, the last century has been a drop in temperature.
Yeah, exactly. Just put the chairs in the 60s.
It's rubbish. I went to a talk. And some poor student passed the question.
I mean, tore into to be honest, you stupid boy. Don't you read my book?
It's sort of like, I was told when I gave the talk that the style here is not to put too much money on the screen. If you could see my hidden slides, you would see my summary of Lawson's rebuttal of the study report.
I don't know what his rebuttal is. He's not a scientist.
Oh, no, no. He
he's a clever guy. And what he has interesting features for a politician, because he combines a good intellect with a profound level of self-awareness. I've sat across the dinner table from him after he gave a talk on this topic. And so he knows he's not a scientist, and so what he did was he convened a group of scientists who had competence in the field but without access to grind, and said, you know, tell me what you find, in the ministerial way. And what they found was really quite alarming. I mean, they describe it as a naive acceptance of...
But it's such an enormous system, you can't change it.
No, exactly.
It's a naive acceptance of the model. Why can't we just store hydrogen as an energy source?
Oh, we can. It's just that it's ferociously inefficient. It is ferociously inefficient. It's the inverse battery problem. What's the battery problem? The battery problem is you have volumetric storage, but you have a surface interaction. And in an electrolysis situation, you have exactly the same thing, but in reverse. You have a boundary around the electrode, and you have a lot of heat generated. Now, when you charge your battery up in your car, it's an electrolysis process. Yep, gets damn hot.
There is a suggestion, if you have a super grid, you can store electricity in car batteries.
One of the byproducts of electric cars. Which they're trying in California, is you leave the cars plugged in and they act as a buffer store. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty feeble sort of solution. Yeah. One of my erstwhile colleagues, a chap called Marcus Newbro, left Cranfield.
Wouldn't we immediately run out of lead?
Oh, no, they don't use lead. They use lithium ion batteries.
Your phone batteries.
Yeah. you might. There's no evidence of it so far. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about. There's this delusion that comes in, particularly in the UK, because we live in such a crowded, congested little island that we like to run out of all things. Go spend time in Florida or Montana, and you'll have a different sort of emotional response to it. There's loads of stuff around. Yes, the shale oil is making a big mess of the area around Alberta. Canada is huge. You make a mess of it and then take 50 years to let it go back to grass.
Then you've got this methane ice. So that's a new thing, but very, very deep down. You've got to build a lot of...
That's a real problem. Because if you've got a sub-oceanic earthquake, it could be
bubbling up. That could be a real problem.
Yeah. That was the theory about the Bermuda Triangle.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, there was a big bubble coming up
on it. Yeah. The boat just...
That left quite a scary image.
I don't quite understand why it's a problem. Electrolysis generates heat. You want heat.
Oh, no, it's about the price of the fuel that comes out of the far end. How about £50 a gallon?
We're talking about storage.
Can you stop buying that table?
The sun is
off. Surely not.
Well, that's true too. But my primary, what lay behind that question for me, was storage for transport. I've got a good storage for you for when the lights go out. When the lights go out, it's called pump storage. Yes. We do it in Wales. That's relatively efficient.
Is that the only? I think it's the only one.
There are one or two around, but again, it's not done because at the time it was considered, power was really very
such
cheap.
A very high capital cost.
Very high capital cost, yeah.
The pumping up of it,
it can be quite cheap because it only wants the power that you're going to generate anyway as base load. Or you use windmills when they're not needed on the grid. So again, the storage issue is really quite interesting.
Of course, that very cold winter we
have.
Go on the web and take a look at Ofgem and look at their 2012 and 2013 reports. They make scary reading. given that you realise that if you take into account the fact that Ofgem is an organisation which can be persuaded not to seriously embarrass the government. So you have to read the bureaucraties in such a way to discount that. Well, what
that's how he
works
me
is you look at 2012 and they sure say this is going to be a problem.
It's a better than even chance of going out by the door at the end of tomorrow.
Which has not long been out, and it says, gosh, it's got worse. Imagine what 2014 is going to be.
Have you heard of this project which unfortunately collapsed called Better Place in Israel to battery changing? I've seen it with operation.
Oh, yes, I've heard of it. Yeah, the quick battery change.
The car drives up in 40 seconds, a robot.
Yeah.
So your subscription is for the batteries. Unfortunately, it's collapsed.
Yeah.
They were going to import 100,000 Renaults. I think they only imported 5,000.
Yeah.
That would be a good solution in the sense that solar energy could be charging these batteries in the garage, ready to...
But better solution is an electric vehicle with a small generator engine, the Vauxhall solution.
Yeah, rather than pure electric.
Yeah.
But actually, I've got a diesel which is zero tax and is better...
Oh, yeah.
Better consumption than any hybrid.
No, absolutely. The only
I came back from London yesterday... to Wallingford, did over 60 to the garden.
Yeah, the sad thing is, like me, you poison a lot of people with the particulates.
But you've got the filter there.
Now you do.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But so it's better, but it's still not as good as a three-way catalyst. Yeah.
When you say three-way, is it taking out three things?
No, it's the three-way catalyst. The standard technology for petrol engines. It burns up excess hydrocarbons, and it uses that to get the catalyst hot, and then it takes out nitrogen and sulfur oxides.
And carbon monoxide.
And carbon monoxide, yes. So a modern gasoline-driven car is very, very good. I mean, there's all this nonsense on the telly about people locking themselves in a garage and turning the car engine on. What they'd get
you can't do it anymore?
No, you'd get a very
bad. Oh, can you not kill yourself that way anymore?
This is terrible.
You're ruining news.
I'm so depressed.
Can't even kill yourself anymore. Yep. That's what they've done.
But what about the noble metals for the catalyst?
We can't run out of noble metals because they don't go anywhere. What you need is a managed process with recovery.
They don't go anywhere, but they get dispersed.
At the moment they do. As that problem moves up the economic priority scale, people will be coming around collecting them. There's already an aftermarket in used catalysts in America. It's the scrap metal thing. Depends where your economy
is. I'm told the platinum mine in South Africa, there's serious industrial disputes there.
Yeah.
And maybe the price of platinum will soar.
One of the things I forebore, because I didn't want to get off into that argument, is of course if you go off to Jupiter, you've got a gas giant there. It has more.
Five pounds.
What is the gas of Jupiter?
Oh, there's a huge volume of methane and other.
So we can mine Jupiter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I was at the Royal Society summer exhibition, and the guy there was demonstrating cables made of carbon nanotubes.
Yes.
You know, which are light. I mean, he actually have this thing that may be the future. So no, these enormous cables that carry the power.
Yes. The Skyhook. I was a science fiction fan. There's a very good set of stories about the sky. And the cost of going to orbit drops to a few dollars a kilo. Yeah. And so the future transport system is you go up a cable, go round an orbit and down another one. And the other fascinating transport system is the tube through the Earth. You know, if you had a technology which would put a tube through, because you step in at one end and 20 minutes later, no matter what the diameter is, you step out at the other at zero velocity. You just better not miss the grab handle.
It's 20 minutes.
Yes, that's the number I remember. I could be wrong. It's a long time ago. It was one of these pop
signs. It gets a bit warm halfway down.
No, indeed. Yes, you would need a good suit.
It's easier to we know more about distant stars in the centre of the Earth.
Oh, indeed, yes.
It isn't a plausible thing in any shape or form, is it?
Oh, but it's a good, fun piece of physics.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Nice to join you.
Thanks.
And interesting. Thanks.
Indeed. Thank you very much. I've given you my email address,
yes.
But I'd love to be able to replay some of this stuff that you've given us. It's so much against the conventional ideas. You know. I love it.
Yeah, well, I will send you a link so you can download
please,
a lecture.
Yes.
It's called an SWF, but I'll tell you how to do it.
Well,
in the link.
I don't know what SWF is, but...
It's a type of file. But all you need is a player for it. It's a flash player.
Okay.
The email has all the instructions on how to do it, because I've had a lot of requests, and it's the easiest way to get it to people.
I don't know how you're going to beat the conventional...
But what will happen ultimately is it won't, if I'm right, and if I'm wrong, I question is where did I go wrong, how can I learn from that? But if I'm right, what will happen is it won't get warmer, and people...
No, that's not what I'm worried about. What I'm worried about is the people who have developed a belief in this global warming thing. I gather that there, around Oxford, there are certain places where if a young person shows doubts, he doesn't get any promotion.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it will fall over. Religious reformation, but it may take quite a long time.
Yes. How long do you think?
Oh, 20 years. As long as it took to set it up.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I have the